Babe Russell in Carmel, California. This is tape number 360. It's October the 27th, 1978, and this is side one. I started to prepare the tape for you on the new pope, the Polish pope, and there was so much material that I decided it would take maybe 2 or 3 weeks, probably 2 weeks, of just going into the last pope or the several popes before him and the role of the Catholic Church in the conspiracies in the past, and a brief history of that, and then predictions of the future and my fears of this new pope. There was so much material that I'm going to put that off until next week and start an analysis of that pope from the material that I already have available. One item before I get started on the tape today is that I've been watching that airplane crash that took place just a month ago in San Diego, the PSA pilot that crashed with a small Cessna. The Cessna went into the wing of the plane, went over San Diego, because our Lieutenant Governor Merv Dimely was supposed to be on that plane and canceled it just as a fluke. His flight he took Sunday night instead of Monday morning. And his opponent is Mike Curb with connections. His campaign is run by Ken Reitz of the Dirty Tricks, of the Richard Nixon Dirty Tricks Department. So if you've been taking the tapes regularly, you can get the background. I have that pretty well covered up to this date. And for those of you that just have this tape on, you'll have to order the back ones. I won't repeat that information. But to update it, there's an article this week in the San Jose Mercury on October the 26th. About the pilot struggling to save the plane. And I thought it was interesting because it has his last remarks on the plane. And then it said that they weren't sure whose voice it was, that there were other crewmen in the airplane. There was a pilot by the name of Bob Fox and an engineer, Martin Wayne. And also in the cockpit was another PSA pilot, Mr. Nelson. But along with them was an Anthony Poli, a co-pilot for the Flying Tiger airline. Poli and Nelson were riding free in the jump seats of the cockpit at the time that these planes crashed. And I thought that was interesting because the Flying Tiger airline was owned partly by Madame Chenault. I don't know if she still owns it or not. It was a CIA airplane, recognized as a CIA plane. And this pilot had along with him a man for the Flying Tiger Airlines that was just sitting there for no special purpose. When the plane went down, this man was there and was identified as coming along for the ride. He was just flying free in the back of the cockpit. That's of interest to me, and I think some of you should know that in the San Francisco Chronicle of the same day, yesterday, October the 26th, they had an article about the pilot and his last remarks on the plane, but didn't mention that anybody from the Flying Tiger Airlines was in the cockpit. That was completely left out of the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Jose Mercury had it. Well, I had mentioned last week on the tape, or the week before, that I would go in to some of the things that have happened to me and my family, and they may have been maybe of interest to you. I get calls all the time on radio shows, how come you're still alive, and a lot of people don't realize, and I don't realize myself, the hazards of doing research until you just put it in a column and add it up. I seem to be able to add up everybody else's problems, but I'm slow to add up the things that have happened to me. And I did compile a list of things that I was going to do one time and put it off because after the summer vacation, I didn't think it would be of any interest to the listeners particularly that we should get right into the James Earl Ray hearings before the House Select Committee. Because the things that happened to me no one would believe anyway, such as being on Vancouver Island and having a rattlesnake in your tent, and when you're gone for the day and a car parked in front of your property, on your property when you go out in the evening, and other people parked there that you can't see, their cars are there and you don't know where they are. And traveling is always a hazard for me, and I expect a certain amount of it. The snake story I'll go into a little more later, but I didn't think anybody would believe it anyway. I took the people that were with me, my daughter, niece, and a friend, and we slept at another friend's that night in the town where the campsite is, and they were laughing because there's no snakes on Vancouver Island, and this was a figment of imagination of the three people that were in the tent and heard it and ran out screaming, and then we told other people, and they said there is no such thing, and then I was quite shaken up when I was down in L.A. a couple of weeks ago to read about Synanon and the rattlesnake in the mailbox, because rattlesnakes are used as a weapon, and I knew this had been planted there. There's no other way it could have happened. It was so frightening to us that we just left the whole tent there, which will cost another $150 to get a new tent next summer. I just left it there and took the kids down to Victoria and decided I couldn't hassle with this because it's, again, one of those things that nobody would believe. And at that time, I began to think of the things that had happened to us and put it off. But the last 2 weeks have been really hard on me. I'm over the hump now. I'm like unsinkable Molly Brown, and I do rally. But I had a terrible time the last 2 weeks, and I feel that the pressure over me, with the exception of a man and woman who have built a house right next to me, and that's still a pressure point for me, and we may go into that. I was under tremendous pressure in the last couple of weeks. I mean, it was really bad. And again, it was part of my psychic ability to help me to forewarn or to move cautiously, which I did, but I feel strong again. And so we'll go on with certain things that have happened in the past and what I was doing that I think probably provoked it. I know that in May 1968, Rose Kennedy was down here in Monterey Peninsula campaigning for Robert Kennedy. And I put a poem in her hands because John Kennedy's birthday was the next day. I remember the date because both of our birthdays are May 29th. And I said, here's a poem in memory of John, and she accepted it. And in it was a letter telling her how Robert was going to be killed. He would be killed from behind. Somebody would be behind him, and they would kill him. And 5 days later, Robert Kennedy was dead. I never did hear from Rose Kennedy or the Secret Service or the FBI or anybody on how I would happen to know that Robert Kennedy would be dead in those within that time period or soon before he ever became a president of the United States. And then it was years later that I found out, after I met Ted Chirac and saw the movie The Second Gun, that I was absolutely convinced that he was, in fact, shot from behind, and the fatal shot didn't come from the front. But one of the things that upset me the day I heard Rose talking, it was at the Mark Thomas Inn over near the airport, was that she was campaigning for Robert, and she sounded so calloused. She could say, we wanted Joe to be president, and then he died in an airplane crash. We wanted John to be president, and he was president 1,000 days, and then he was killed. And she sort of rattled off, and now I want you to let Bobby be president of the United States. And my first feeling was, what a hard-ass bitch. I mean, this woman's going out and telling you to put her third son up for president. And it just sounded so cold, the way she rattled it off. It was just hard to explain. It was so matter-of-fact, like, here's the next one we're giving our country, and line up. But it stayed with me. Her voice stayed with me in the way she did it. And then when I was thinking of the things I wanted to share with you that happened to our family, I didn't want you to have the same feeling. I can talk about my car being on fire, my son being given acid, or Bonnie being killed, and Barbara almost killed, and I can run down these things. And I don't want you to think like I felt about Rose Kennedy, and maybe I judged her wrong, because there's no way to evaluate the silent hours or the years of crying. There's just no way to tell you how I feel. Even when I talk about it, I tell you, I feel it. But I'm just telling you in chronological order some of the things that have happened, because I think they should be of interest to you and any other researcher who is trying to find out some truths about this world, not only our country, but the world. An incident took place several weeks ago with Bob Trevor up at KGO. I was supposed to be on KGO Sunday night, September the 15th it was, and he had done a promotion for a long time. We do conference calls to the house, and he had told people for 3 weeks or so that I would be up on Sunday night at the station. The station is on Golden Gate in San Francisco. It's a lonely area. When you leave there at 12 o'clock at night, every time I've been there, a certain gentleman has jumped up towards me. He hasn't hurt me, and he's given me his card and identification. He's had something to tell me. But he jumps right out of the building when I come and follows me to the car. And I've had other instances of car chases in San Francisco that I will talk about. And I agreed to go there, even though it was 9 to 12. I wasn't too afraid. But the story of the rattlesnake broke, and that was a week before the Synanon story, and that really convinced me that my feelings about the man on the property whose license I had taken and the planting of the stake had happened to me, just as it happened to that lawyer who was fighting Synanon. And then the week before I was to go up to Bob Trevor in San Francisco, the wheels came off my tire. If any of you live nearby me or have gone up the hill here to my home. I'm a mile and a tenth straight up a steep hill, and I came down that hill and just happened to have a half hour to spare before meeting somebody. It was a fluke that I had the half hour because I'm usually pretty punctual and I was off on my time. So I stopped at the gas station to fill up with gasoline so I don't have to waste that extra time. And I was half full, and when I turned out of the gasoline station and turned my tires, the wheels were hitting the fenders, and I knew that they weren't punched in, that I hadn't had an accident. So I made a circle around the gas station and left the car there, and they told me that the nuts in the lower control arm were missing, and they had been taken off. I don't know how it happened, but the wheels had dropped down and were hitting the fender. And if I'd gone down the hill, I would have had no control of the car. And they told me at the Union Station that he had never seen something like this. They suggested that I lock the car at night because you'd have to get into the hood there. And so the first time in my life in all the years that I've had a car, except for being in the cities where you lock the car, I'm locking the car just as a precautionary thing, which I don't like to do. I don't like that kind of paranoia to think that something would happen where my neighbors could come up, or because otherwise you'd hear cars around here at night on the hill. You can hear them coming up the hill. But then the Friday before I was supposed to go to San Francisco, I got a phone call with a phony Mexican accent. Do you believe in Jesus? You better pray to the Lord because you're going to die. And when you die, you will be praying and you're going to die soon. And the day that I got that, it was on Friday in September, and I had an appointment that day. It was the 12th with Reverend Dumke, and he was coming down with two people to work on some information about the CIA and the Patty Hearst case. And I didn't know whether the threat was coming from the future trial that's going to take place in the Bay Area, the Manson, Charles Winnan trial versus Paul Krasner and Rolling Stone magazine. That's a $60 million trial with Melvin Belli representing the prosecution. And I'm really the hinging primary witness in this particular trial that holds this defense together. The Rolling Stones have spent about $2 million in legal fees already. It's a big trial, and a lot of it hinges. I'm the main witness in this trial that got the story rolling in the first place. I'm not a defendant in the trial. I don't think a court of law would sensibly take on a lot of the things that I have alleged or charged, but they're taking on Rolling Stone. I didn't even write the article for them, but I made the introduction of Paul Krasner to the people who had information about supplying the drugs for the Manson family. Well, because this trial is coming up and because of the work I'm doing on the House Select Committee or with the Patty Hearst Committee, or being public on so many things, I didn't know whether pressure was coming, but I did call Bob and asked if I could do it from the house, that I'd feel more secure. And he said I could, and I didn't go to San Francisco because I just didn't want to be on the road. Again, I got a call one night from the police department in Carmel impersonating the police department. It wasn't from them at all, saying my daughter was there, and this was 10 o'clock at night, that she'd been picked up on the beach and was smoking marijuana. And Barbara doesn't have drugs or marijuana, and she was over 21, so I don't know why I'd have to release her anyway, but I said I'd come down there. And then, again, a fluke, a telephone show, I think it was in St. Paul, somewhere in the East, I had a telephone conference call, and I called the police department to say that I'd be just a half hour late, that she shouldn't expect me for a half hour, an hour, and they said she wasn't even there, and we checked the university, and she was at her night classes. So again, I'd be coming down this dark hill on a lonely road down Carmel Valley Road, and it was a fluke. So that I had the feeling that something like this could come on the way home from KGO, and I did that conference call so that the wheels coming off the car and the rattlesnake story breaking, that it is, the snake is used as a weapon, and then the death threat, I decided to play it safe and stay home. But I had made out a list in chronological order of things that have happened to me and my family, and I'll briefly run them down, and some of them will go into detail and others will pass off pretty fast. When I went to New Orleans to see District Attorney Jim Garrison, he had arrested Clay Shaw, and David Ferry had then been killed promptly. I didn't want Jim to make reservations for me. He wanted to make them at a hotel in New Orleans. I said, I'll make my own because I figured somebody in his office would then know where I was staying, and I got a cab, went into the French Quarter of New Orleans, stayed at this very quaint hotel, put the bolt on the door, locked my door, went to sleep. The next morning took a cab to see District Attorney Jim Garrison and spent the day with him, was at his home in the evening, had dinner out, came home, and back to the hotel room, put my things down and looked, and the lock was taken off the door. I had my luggage kept in Dallas, Texas, 5 days from that trip. This was in 1967. They kept all my research and flew it back on a special plane. I had locks torn off my luggage when I went to Dayton, Ohio to speak. My plane tickets had been canceled. There was a bomb scare on one plane that came from Georgia to Dallas. I never knew until I got my Freedom of Information papers, a few of them, where the bomb scare came from. That was after I was visiting Jim Garrison. I've had a near collision of an airplane coming out of Sacramento. The wheels have come off a plane going to O'Hare Airport in Chicago on the way to Dayton, Ohio. My oldest son, Marvin, was given acid by Carolyn Gilman. Carolyn and Peter have worked with the intelligence community. This was in 67 while I was in New Orleans. My other son, David, had dinner with an instructor who teaches. He's from Brazil at the DLI language school. We trusted him and knew him a long time. His name is Lee. And the night after David had dinner, 20 minutes later, he sort of conked out and was hazy and drove home, and on the way home had a car crash and was almost killed. He was all right. He was thrown out of the car, but it could have been a really serious incident. And he never called Lee again. Subconsciously, he must have associated the dinner or something with the accident, because the man had been a driver. He'd come up from Brazil and was going to UCLA and worked for my first husband, and the boys went to a private school, and he moved into the house and was driving the boys around. And then when we moved up here, he had come up here and was teaching language at the Defense Language School in the department. He's from Brazil. I've had my car on fire twice, both two different cars. One was a Mercury station wagon and one was a Saab. One went up in flames and the other, the plate just burned black, and they told me to save it as a souvenir because it seemed the way the Saab was built, it didn't go up in flames, but the other one almost blew up. And again, a fluke, a man up at Grants Pass at the gas station put his arms around me and the person I was with and said, "You were really meant to live," because at that point it was raining and a rainbow came out, and somebody behind us had helped put out the fire and we weren't blown up. I've seen my best friends, such as Louise James, her mind drug, the same kind of acid trip that Marvin got, memory erased, dropped her political activity, and we'll do a little more about Louise, too, because I was close to her in the Carmel area. Up in Canada this summer, we parked by a lake coming home outside of Washington. We were in Washington State and got this huge 4-inch bolt that ripped a brand-new tire. It's about a quarter of an inch wide, and I have it hanging from a ribbon in my kitchen as a souvenir, because again, when we got to the gas station, they said they had never seen anything like this. It wasn't pointed, it wasn't like a nail, it was just a huge bolt, which they believed probably had to be placed backward or forward onto the tire. So that we had a tent trailer that you park and then your car pulls forward because the sides of the tent trailer come down and there's no space because the back of the car is there. And then in the morning, you back up to attach it. So whether you go forward or backward, there was somebody outside the tent at 6 in the morning, and my niece heard it, and she was yelling, and my daughter said, "Shut up," and she said, "No, there's noise," and she heard somebody opening and closing the food box, and she heard this noise, and it was cold and kind of dark. We went back to sleep till 7, and we weren't on the road 20 minutes when this tire, our tire was low, and we were aware of the fact that it wasn't completely flat, but the bolt was so big it didn't make it flat. But it was a new tire before we left, and it had to be wrenched out, and the tire was thrown away. It couldn't be patched in any way. So we have a souvenir. There was a man that pulled up next to us where we camped who had a sheriff. He was campaigning for somebody, for sheriff of the area. I don't know whether it was himself or a friend. And they pulled up and joined us at night, had some hot chocolate, and talked by the campsite. And their son talked with my daughter and niece and friend, you know, and they came over and visited, and I don't know whether it had anything to do with those people, but somebody was walking around outside about 6 in the morning, and then about 7:30, our tire was completely gone. And as I say, I've had the wheel now cut off. Some kind of a nut was loose or detached or almost ready to fall off and fell off. And I have, from the Freedom of Information Act, they at least printed the letter, a copy of the letter of the death threat I got from Sandra Good. That was in 1975 when I was comparing the roots of the SLA to the Manson family and the origins of their being formed by the intelligence, the Pentagon, and the COINTEL programs. Sandra Good was telephoning me and writing me letters and threatening me with being killed by the Manson family. I've had planes where cancellations took place that malfunctioned. One out of Sacramento that would have held up a trip to New York, I had to go the next day, and another one in Chicago O'Hare Airport where we were ready to board and a TWA was malfunctioning. And we had to wait, and they took the luggage off and brought new meals in and changed planes and general commotion. And when we went to where we were supposed to be to line up for the next plane, they had another plane listed, and we were running all over the airport in general confusion. I've had the home burglarized, correspondence with Clarence Kelly removed, and film clips from the Howard Hughes mystery were destroyed. I went down to Los Angeles to make scenes, the opening and closing scenes of that movie, and then they were physically destroyed, taken to the lab and physically destroyed, and Emanuel Zecina, the producer, decided to remake those scenes, and this time I did it with an actor who's on the Love Boat, I forget his name. We did the scenes again, and then once again he had trouble, and now I understand that he's, you know, ready to get back and do it again, and he's determined to get the movie out. And other things have happened with people around me. I'll go into those also that are treacherous. The most treacherous of associates working with me was Don Steiny. We were working on the story of Don Bowles and the link of the information the reporter was trying to find out with what really happened, which was the Howard Hughes connections to the mining swindle in Arizona and the stock market, the fraudulent stock market manipulation that was taking place at the time, and trying to link the Bulls not only to Emprise. When he died, he said Emprise, but it wasn't organized crime that killed him, but it was his link to the Hughes organization. And we were working on that when Don Steiny was telling people about that, and then he was in a car and was driving with two people, one whose son is in the FBI, his father's in the FBI, not the son, another with a so-called friend from Santa Barbara. There was a big car crash. It involved a police chase. They hit a police car. The driver, so-called non-interested or involved person, according to Don Steiny, the son of the FBI man, had been drinking. This fellow never went to jail or had any problems for bumping into a police car, which had a blockade or drunk driving or the accident that took place. But Don was thrown out of the car. And he had three brain surgeries and almost died. He was in intensive care and in serious condition. The fellow from Santa Barbara that was in the car left that same day and went on down to Santa Barbara and didn't even ask how Don was. And he just was in terrible shape. He was left legally blind. He's back at UC Santa Cruz doing very well as a student, although he really can't see. He had a high IQ. And, of course, the article stopped and the work on the Howard Hughes book at that point stopped. We were co-authoring a book on Howard Hughes, and we just put it on the shelf and couldn't do any more. That was put away. Not that I won't get back to the Hughes book, but that's what happened to Don. And then, of course, I'm talking about the things that happened to me. We'll talk about the accident that took place in December 1970 when Bonnie was killed, my daughter and her dancing teacher and her best friend. And also there were six others in the car that were hurt, and one of them was my other daughter, Barbara, who was almost killed and had a broken back and a broken leg that had traction and pins in it. Her left leg had was completely shattered. The kneecap had to be rebroken and set the next year, and her right leg was broken in about 20 places, and she had a broken arm and a cast and a cut from her temple on down her face, her forehead, and a broken nose. And she was at community hospital, first taken to Fort Ord Hospital and then community hospital. And she's in fine condition now, except for a man that I think that is an agent. I've talked about him, and I'll do a little more about that if we have time. But that was the worst thing that happened. And the acid for Marvin was the next worst thing that's happened in my family, and the near plane crashes were bad. The car fires were terrible. The scares the last few weeks, the snake in Canada was bad. The tires coming off is terrible. There is an accumulation of things that has happened to me, and some of them we'll do a little more detail on. The FBI has not sent me the full story of the surveillance that took place. They've sent me just about 20 pages, and goodness knows I have a list of the political things that I've been doing since 1963-64, and I know they have more on me than that, particularly since they had orders to follow all people who are questioning the Warren Commission, and they only sent me a few pages. But in 1966 is the first indication that I was under surveillance, and that is an FBI report that I sent a letter to the editor from the Monterey Herald defending Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment. I tell people write letters to the editor, but I have to tell you that if you do write letters to the editor, and I'm sure even if you call talk shows, they have us all down in their computer. September 18th, 1967, when I came home from New Orleans, and I have this on another tape going back to my Freedom of Information Act, but I just want to repeat this one sentence. The FBI said, due to the fact that Mrs. Brussel has been in contact with Jim Garrison in New Orleans and made public comments concerning the assassination investigations, the FBI and the Secret Service should immediately begin a file on her. They said, due to her thinking that she expressed publicly that the United States is becoming fascist and that she pictures America as controlled by conspirators in the government, and she has stated that publicly, they repeated that, stated it publicly, we are in incorporate memorandum suitable for dissemination to the FBI and Secret Service, I suppose all over the country. Well, as I say, that was in 1966 that the surveillance began, at least the report that they're giving me. I look back now, and I believe that in 1964, when I wrote to the government printing office for a set of the hearings on the assassination of John Kennedy, the hearings before the commission, that that must have been when the surveillance began, because there are only 8,000 copies of those printed, and they stopped at 8,000. And recently somebody told me at the university in Utah, when he wanted to read one of the volumes, he had to leave his Social Security number to check out, read it there, and read the volumes on the assassination of John Kennedy. But having libraries and personal people reading it, it certainly isn't hard to see which of the 8,000 people are doing their work. Shirley Martin is another woman that started investigating the assassination of John Kennedy very early, and I think she got some articles out and was among the first researchers, along with 11 or 12 others like myself. And then her daughter was killed in an automobile accident in Oklahoma, and Shirley Martin never was active as a researcher again. She stopped right there, and that was the end of her work, as far as I understand. I have never heard much about her since, or know people that have been working with her, and haven't read anything she's written. And at the time, they said that her daughter had been killed in an automobile crash. So I believe just ordering the commission hearings in 1964 would have been reason for surveillance. And now that we look back over the 30 years of FBI, and since 47, the CIA formation of keeping track of people, and the Pentagon keeping millions of names during the whole anti-war period, if not before, we know that they have more information, but they're not releasing it. In 1967, before I went to New Orleans to see Jim Garrison, I was at Kezar Stadium in San Francisco, and there was a large anti-war demonstration, and there are 21 booths or tables. And I went up purposely early or a day early and went to these different booths, and there was Mr. Arnani, who had a magazine called The Majority of One. He had been a victim of a Nazi concentration camp. There was the Youth Against Fascism, the Black Panthers. And I had a big poster which said, next march to the National Archives. They had all this energy around Kezar Stadium, and the sign said, find out who killed JFK, because I believed that the war escalated right after the death of Kennedy, and if you wanted to stop the war in Vietnam, solve the assassination story, and you'd find out who's escalating the war in Southeast Asia. Well, of course, nobody took me seriously. Nobody at those tables thought that this was important. Arnani had written some articles on John Kennedy, marvelous things, and he is a great, great person. I don't want to put him down. But nobody felt that this was a good suggestion to march through the National Archives and call attention to the fact of the murder of a president. I don't know now if it might have staved off the killing of Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy, if history would have been changed if people had considered the fact of being visual. But I had signs and was visual in those days, and I have a picture of the placard I was signing about wanting the same energy there to go into finding out who was doing the killings. But then after that period in 67, I went to see Jim Garrison in New Orleans, and as I said, I stayed at the hotel in the French Quarter. My lock was removed from the hotel door. My notebooks were kept. There was this bomb scare when we went to Dallas. We were supposed to change planes, and when I got as far as Dallas, we were told to take off our seat belts. They got a call. There was a bomb on the plane. And at that time, I was taken by the Dallas policeman into a separate room other than all the other passengers. And they were allowed to board first, and then agents stood there and saw the papers and notebooks I had brought for Jim Garrison and kept them in Dallas, kept them 5 days, and returned them 5 days later on a special plane back to Monterey, all the material that I brought to Jim Garrison. I'll do more about this now on the other side, side two of the tape.